Good morning. My name is Ernestine Miller. I am part of the host committee here in New York, the Casey Stengel chapter, and we are so delighted to see such a great turnout for this convention, Saber 47. So welcome to New York, and every single great convention, every great convention needs a lead-off program that is as the best it can be. And I am very happy to say we have that this morning. Two women who are at the pinnacle of their profession, an amazing executive with the New York Yankees, a woman who has been there for 16 years and has a World Series ring. Jean, would you please hold up your ring? A World Series ring. And if you do not think working for 16 years with the people she has to work with and still smiling, still has her sense of humor and her wits, two different things, we are delighted to have Jean, and she is going to be interviewed this morning by Claire Smith. Claire. As most of you know, 1 month from now, in a lovely little town several hundred miles upstate, Claire is the recipient of the 64th J.G. Taylor Sphinx Award for Excellence in Journalism. The first woman. The first woman to receive this honor, joining the ranks of Red Barber, Sam Lacy, Grantlin Wrights, the really greats of the industry, and another great to be added. So these two women, I do not know, you're much too young to be thinking about your legacy, but you have one. You have left your mark on your, not only your individual organizations, but you have left your mark for a long time to come. So it is my great pleasure on this Saber stage to introduce Jean Afterman and Claire Smith. And Claire will be interviewing Jean.
Such an honor to be here with Jean, and I thank you for that warm welcome. You're lovely. If there are any members of the BBWAA in the audience, I know I saw Barry and Steve Jacobson. I thank you very much for your support over 35 years.
I forgot one job. I had a job. I apologize. If you have any questions, there are cards on the back tables. Please write your questions on the cards. There will be an opportunity for Q&A, and we will take the questions from the cards that you ask the questions from. I'm sorry to interrupt. I had one thing to remember.
And I'll zoom through my questions as quickly as possible and as painlessly as possible, Jean.
Well, I actually think I should be interviewing you.
No. Okay, the first question. This is the most hostile. Coming from a lifelong Dodger fan, could easily be by, why the Giants? But seriously, Jane, could you describe your earliest memories of the game?
Yes, actually. Somebody who has been a lifelong, who feels lifelong hostility towards the Dodgers. I was born and raised in San Francisco. And I, as a side note, I mean, there are a lot of teams that are represented here, and I also see a lot of Mets fans. And I know it's not very Yankee to say this, but just as when I was growing up, the Bay Area could, you know, we had a National League and an American League team, and the area was certainly large enough for both teams. I certainly feel that, you know, New York is large enough for an American League and a National League team. So, but I grew up in San Francisco, and so Candlestick Park was where I first saw baseball. I got several quad Candlesticks. A little, I don't know if there are Giants fans here who, yes, so you remember we got, if you stayed through extra innings when the fog was pouring in and it was about 50 degrees, you got a little quad Candlestick. So those are my earliest memories. We sat in the bleachers. My mother's 90. She's a wild baseball fan now, but then she was not a sports fan, so she would take us, oh, God, another baseball game. And she would sit there huddled up with a murder mystery reading throughout the entire game. So those are my earliest memories. And hating the Dodgers, earliest memory.
Well, you're forgiven. It sounds idyllic, though. Did you always know you'd end up somehow connected with or working in baseball?
Not at all. Never in a million years. I don't even think that I contemplated that I would be in baseball as early as 25 years ago, because I think this is my 23rd year working in baseball. And it was never in my mind. I was fortunate that I was in the right place at the right time to sort of launch into baseball and in a different way, and here I am.
Okay, so can you explain your path, how you now are with the Yankees, the roads taken and the roads not taken?
So I went to law school at a slightly later age, in my 30s, and that made all the difference for me. At a time when I was working in the movie industry, and I had kind of hit a ceiling. At that time, in the mid-1980s, there really weren't a lot of women. There was Sherry Lansing and Dawn Steele, titans of the industry, but women really weren't working at high levels in below the line, which is the production side of sports. And I had a friend at Paramount Pictures who said to me, you know, well, you just seem a little too smart to be doing what you're doing, which was basically writing down the number of inches that had been filmed, writing down the number of minutes, you know, and then reporting them. So he said, why don't you go to law school? And we're not lawyers in my family, so at first I thought to myself, law school? Why would anybody go to law school? But I did. I took the LSATs. Still those dang word problems, you know, same thing. SATs, LSATs, I those word problems. I hate them. And so I went to law school. I thought I would go back to Los Angeles and be a big-time entertainment attorney, but I wasn't. I was in a small civil litigation firm in the Valley, and one of our clients was Don Nomura. We did a lot of real estate work for him, and Don is Japanese. His father was American, based in Tokyo, and he had an exclusive license for Japanese baseball cards. And this is before Nomo, so Japanese baseball was nothing to the United States. And he had a dispute. An American company had come over and infringed on his licenses, and so he came into the very small firm and he asked if, you know, if we wanted to handle the case. And nobody else did, but it involved a free trip to Japan. And so I raised my hand, and I went to Japan in 1994. I always feel like now that we're in 2017, you know, in 1994, I went to Japan.
Back in the last century.
Back in the last century. Yes. So in 1990, I went to Japan, and that was actually Matsui's rookie year. So he took me to a Yomiuri Giants baseball game. I remember Hideki standing there, you know, stick straight up. And the baseball seemed to be so advanced and just as if I were watching a Major League Baseball game, just a high quality of play, that I asked Don why there weren't more Japanese baseball players playing in the United States. And it was almost like Don was like, oh, I hope she asked me this. And he turned to me and he said, well, there's a 1967 agreement between the U.S. commissioner and the Japanese commissioner that prohibits Japanese players from playing in the United States. And I'd only been a lawyer for a couple of years, and like every newly minted lawyer, you know, something that's like, well, that does not seem legal to me. You know, it's a violation of the Constitution, and I'm, you know, oh, everything is an amendment. But as it turned out, in our view, it wasn't legal. And so Don said that he had been looking for a professional Japanese player who was willing to challenge the system. And at that time in Japan, they had a saying that the nail that stands up gets hit down, whereas in the United States, everything is a violation, and you know, you stand up for your rights. And so he felt that he had found a player who had the courage and the wherewithal to stand up and challenge the system, and that was Hideo Nomo. And Nomo came over here. There was a loophole in the agreement that said that a Japanese player that voluntarily retired was free to sign with any club he wanted to. So we took that loophole and we brought Nomo over here, and nobody paid any attention. Major League Baseball didn't pay any attention, and Nippon Professional Baseball didn't pay any attention because they thought this would just be a flash in the pan. You know, oh great, you know, Japanese player would come over here, he would fail, he'd go back, we don't even have to address any issues. But instead, you know, Nomo came over here and was absolutely, you know, a phenom, and he, I think, I believe he saved baseball in 1995 because it was after the strike and fans were very disenchanted with baseball. And he was new and exciting and brought an aspect to baseball, the international aspect, the global aspect to baseball that people were, you know, gravitated towards. And one giant Dodger story, so he made his debut at Candlestick. And obviously when he came in, I brought my whole family and I stood up and applauded. And my mother grabbed me by the sleeve. Sit down, you're embarrassing us. So, but he, you know, he was phenomenal. And so Don and I, that started kind of a series of cases for us with Japanese players. There was a Dominican connection, and Alfonso Soriano was our next case. And by then, you know, both commissioners' offices had sort of taken notice that this was a legal problem that was not going to go away. And Alfonso Soriano, we used a different loophole, which was the Japanese rules said that if you go to arbitration, salary arbitration, and you lose, and you either accept what the decision is or you will be voluntarily retired, which was considered punitive because nobody wants to be X'd out of their profession. So they thought that would be, you know, a punishment. So we went to salary arbitration. I think our salary demand was something like $260,000, I think, which was the major league minimum at the time in the States, I think. So, which was a completely reasonable demand, but players almost never went to arbitration in Japan. And of course, it was heard by the commissioner and the two league presidents, and you can imagine, what the outcome of that was going to be. Right. So I was not allowed in the room as a foreigner and as a foreign lawyer. So Don was in the room, but not allowed to speak, I think. And so Soriano lost his arbitration, and they voluntarily retired him. And we waited for the voluntarily retired papers, you know, faxes. It comes through, you know, and I got the Dear Mr. Afterman. So the minute I saw the letterhead from the Nippon Professional Baseball Commissioner's Office and the Mr. Afterman come through, I knew that we were golden. So so he voluntarily retired, came over here as a voluntary retired player to sign with any club. That was a little bit different because his Japanese club sent a letter to all 30 clubs saying, we will come over here, we will sue you if you sign Soriano. So many people know a lot of stories about George Steinbrenner, and you knew him well. So that's just waving the red flag in front of George. That was just waving. Nobody was going to tell him not to sign a free agent player. And I remember that his general counsel at the time called me and asked me to send a letter outlining why Soriano was absolutely a free agent, because, you know, George was willing to go to war, but he wanted to be assured that he was a free agent. So I laid out this article in the Japanese rules and that, you know, I made my case, and for George, that was good enough. So Soriano, there were other clubs interested. At the time, the union was very influential, and at that time, the union could become involved if you got at least one club to say that if he were a free agent, they would offer him a major league contract. So Cleveland, Baltimore, and the Yankees all submitted letters saying if he were a free agent, very carefully worded, of course, if he were a free agent, and we're not saying he is, if he were a free agent, we would offer a major league contract. So Soriano came over here. The Yankees ended up not being sued. And then the last sort of big case building on the other two was Irabu. And Irabu was building on the others, but was slightly different because his club had just sold his rights to the San Diego Padres without his permission. So that was the 6 month, as we call it, you know, the Irabu crisis, as we call it. And so for 6 months, his future hung in the balance, and which is very hard. You know, if you're a player and the alternative is to basically pump gas, as Don and I used to say, you know, you either can play baseball or you're going to relegate him to pumping gas. And so eventually that gave rise to the posting system, which was not something that Don and I particularly thought was a good idea. But anyway, long answer. Now you've had more than you ever thought you'd know about U.S.-Japan baseball relations.
that's fascinating. You broke a barrier there.
Well,
you broke a barrier there.
Well, we thought in a lot of ways, without any hubris attached to it, but we did think that you know, baseball has broken barriers before, and you know, we'll probably continue to do so, and that's a legacy of baseball, is to make sure that anyone and everyone can be included in the game. So we wanted to think so, and
that's a great story. It really is. Now, today, you're the only female assistant GM in the game, and only the third ever, following Elaine Stewart of the Red Sox and Kim Young, who preceded you with the Yankees. Please correct me on the pronunciation of Kim's last name.
Ng.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. Apologies to Kim. No woman has ever risen higher than that position in player development, despite many efforts of candidates like Kim. Do you think that women will ever receive more opportunities in this area of the sport?
I do. I think that, I do also want to make the point that George Steinbrenner and Brian Cashman are the two in all of professional sports around the world, the only owner and general manager who hired not one but two female assistant GMs. And I think that's, you know, once again, I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of the Yankees. I think that front offices are kind of cyclical. So originally front offices were manned by ex-ball players. Then that kind of evolved to, for a period of time, everybody thought, well, I got to be a scout, you know. And so then that evolved to Ivy League men. So then young Ivy League men. And now, you know, there's really the only requirement to be a front office executive is brains, you know, to be smart. And smart is something that's gender blind. You know, that's something that it doesn't matter, male, female, or you know, undeclared. You are you. If you use your mind, if you have a brain, then you can achieve anything. So I do think that there will be women moving up into the ranks. They have to have the opportunity. And young women, or I wasn't particularly young when I came into a run office. Women of any age should know that there are opportunities there. So I do think that's going to change. I hope sooner rather than later.
So what advice would you give young women entering or exiting college who would want to follow in your footsteps?
I think that, so baseball front offices have really staffed up in analytics and math. Those things that were highly specialized, you can sort of paint yourself into a corner if you only, you know, are analytical. So, Commissioner Manfred, there used to be, Commissioner Selig had the Selig rule. So the Selig rule, which I think was a rule that was completely unworkable, was that, you know, clubs were forced to interview either a woman or for a person of color for a assistant GM or GM job, and didn't matter who they were. Just you had to tick that box. So what ended up happening, I know Kim went for, you know, several interviews. Willie Randolph went a few times. You know, everybody, they would, and the club would then tick the box and say, okay, done. Now I can hire the white guy I wanted to hire. So it wasn't a workable system. Commissioner Manfred saw that that you have to create a pipeline, a diversity pipeline. So he formed a committee. I'm on his diversity pipeline committee. We have a couple of white guys on, just to show that we're open to everybody, and for that perspective. The committee was tasked with just what you're saying, creating opportunities for anyone to enter a front office and breaking down maybe some of the barriers. And the idea is that front office executives don't spring like Venus out of the waves, fully formed. You have to have a career path. You have to start, you know, at the beginning. And so the idea is that to have people at the beginning, so they come in as interns or associates, or and then create a pipeline to the assistant general manager or the general manager job. So it's a process of years, and sometimes, you know, people do things for the right things, right reasons. They do things because it looks like the right thing to do, or they do things because they're forced to do it. And we sort of feel that the pipeline is kind of a combination of the three. So I think the question for women is knowing that the opportunities are there, approaching the club that seems to be the most receptive, and then moving in to those positions and starting and being moved through the system. I have myself not found it. I've never, you know, experienced in the Yankees gender discrimination. I had more gender discrimination in California Superior Court than I ever had in baseball. But I came in as a lawyer, and so young people, men or women, who are coming in just at the start of it, it's a village, 30 clubs, limited jobs, but those, just to know their opportunities and be prepared. So sometimes I feel like, you know, don't do drugs and stay in school is what I always tell students. But education has made the difference for me and would make the difference for anybody.
Now, getting back to the transition in your life, how unusual is it for an agent who sat across from a Brian Cashman to jump to the other side?
So there was one other agent that jumped to the other side, but he managed to actually have the money to buy a team. So I never had that money. I knew the Yankees for a good number of years, and I'd sat across the table from Brian and from George, and we were, we had a lot of, vigorous conversations. And when Kim decided to leave and go to the Dodgers, Brian, I guess, thought of me. I was representing players, lived in San Francisco, and was down, I think, in Los Angeles seeing a client. And I came back, and in the old days of phone machines, you know, where you'd come back and there'd be a light beeping. So the light was beeping. It was late at night. I played the message, and Brian, it was Brian's voice, "Hello, Jean, Brian Cashman. I just had a thought, you know, maybe reaching out to you to discuss something." And usually that was his tone of voice when, unfortunately, Irabu may have misbehaved. So I'd get a message, "Jean, just reaching out, need to talk to you or Don." You know? So I thought to myself, I don't have any clients with the Yankees now. And it was late at night with a three-hour difference, so I waited in the morning. I called him back, and he said, "Well, I was coming back on a flight from Tampa. I'd just, been down with a meeting with George, and I looked over the aisle, and there was a woman that, you know, that reminded me of you." I've never asked him why. I don't even think I even want to know why. So the woman reminded me of you, and I just thought, why?
Interesting.
Well, I'll ask Gene. Someday, I'm going to ask him. Be careful what you ask, I know.
Okay.
But I think that, as a former agent, it's in the same way that I think if you're a lawyer, you should represent plaintiffs and defendants, because you get both sides, and it makes you more It makes you bigger, better, faster, stronger, because you know the way the other side is thinking. So a lot of times when I do a contract, I will throw everything, including the kitchen sink, into the contract. So I'll put all kinds of provisions that I know are illegal, unenforceable, that every agent, it's really, it, you know, agent's going to read it and go, no, 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 no. And then so that I can, so I know that I can give in on those. And then keep the stuff that I want included in there. So, wow. I love that. Mine is just one of those. I have it on vibrate all the time. So,
Sorry. Sorry.
No, no. So I think that that's, you know, I think that, and there may be more agents, because when I left the agent side of it, the geography for agents, it's just not good. I mean, you are constantly defending yourself against, you know, the other agents stealing your clients. And it's also not, it's not Jerry Maguire. I mean, you don't make millions of dollars. You travel across the country on your own dime. And sometimes, you know, you can be let go because you got only free pairs of shoes instead of seven free pairs of shoes for somebody. So,
you're often demonized as well, right?
Yes, you are
often
demonized. By
that often awful media.
But I agree with you. I think those naughty media people. I think agents, I mean, in our personal lives, it's very difficult to negotiate for yourself. Just much easier to advocate for a friend or a family member. But for yourself, even I kind of, you know, if the landlord doesn't fix the air conditioning, you know, soon enough, I'm on the phone, do you think maybe next week you could do it? Whereas if it were your air conditioning, I would, but this is a health and safety violation, you know, I'm going to call the New York Attorney General. So everybody needs an advocate. And agents, it's very important to have distance between the person you're negotiating with and yourself, having that so you have plausible deniability, like, I never asked for that.
What's your most vivid memory of working with George?
Well, they're all very vivid. He was a remarkable and vivid character, mythic and legendary, and it's astonishing to me that he's not in the Hall of Fame, because he is you know, a Hall of Fame owner, I told this story recently about Irabu's. You know, when he wanted to send Irabu back to me, so I don't think I'll do that. Don and I had one negotiation with George. Before I came to the Yankees, I could call him George. When I came to the Yankees, it had to be Mr. Steinbrenner. But for me, never the boss, because that's Bruce Springsteen. So I remember Don and I called this. I don't know if anybody ever watched the Wild Wild West way back when,
yes.
But the TV show, yes. And they always had the night of. So this was for us the night of the bad tuna. So we were down in Tampa. They had a bunker, we always airless, windowless. I think that was part of the technique to put you in this airless, windowless bunker and have you negotiate. And it may have been Irabu or Katz Maeda. No, it was Irabu, I think. Or Soriano, you know, when you get to be my age, it just all kind of blends together. It was a client, and we had settled on a number. He said, okay, that's it. I'm going to dinner. We'll work out the details when I get back. So we stayed with the other Yankee executives, kind of talking over things. The number was set, and George comes back, and he walks in, and he goes, you know, I had a tuna that I just don't think was sat right with me, and it gave me an opportunity to think that I just don't really think that's the number I want to go to. So of course, once again, when you advocate for somebody else, I mean, if I'd been advocating for myself, I would have been, well, okay, what number do you want to pay? But, you know, since you're advocating for somebody else, like, what? Feathers flew, and eventually, you know, he came back to the number that he had agreed to. But yeah, that was the night of the bad tuna. And every time thereafter, when we were negotiating with George, it was like, this is going to be pre-meal or post-meal.
That's great. Have you ever tried to talk Brian out of rappelling down a building or making a sketchy trade?
So I'll answer the second one first. Okay. So the great thing about Brian is that he pulls in everybody's point of view. He never does anything solely on what he thinks. He wants to hear everybody in the baseball operations department, the pro scouts, the analysts, anybody that you know has something substantive that will go into the trade. So you know, when he hired me, I'm not he said, I don't want a talent evaluator. I don't want a scout. I have plenty of scouts. You know, I need you to you know, do for the Yankees what you did for players and all that sort of stuff. But when the room, you know, when we go around the room and everybody has an opinion, you know, you're a yes, you're a no, you're a yes, you're a no. So there are times when I've actually had a point of view and, you know, I do express it. So rarely, but every once in a while. The repelling, man, you know, now he wants to swim with sharks. That's his thing that he wants to do. And he jumped out of an airplane. And for me, there is no reason to jump out of an able aircraft. So that's my thing. Unless it's going down, you don't jump out. So I think that's his, you know, that's his thing. But the thing about rappelling down a building is that he actually rappels down the building and dressed like Tinkerbell. Is what it really looks like. He's dressed like an elf. So I think rappelling down the building is okay, but you know, like green tights? That's so undignified. But it's for charity, so it's a great thing.
He is so funny.
He is funny.
Only two left, and then I'm going to throw you
to the shark
to the
tank.
Hands of these lovely people. What's the most surprising challenge and rewards you found working in the Bronx?
In the Bronx?
Yes.
Challenges are, and I know this is a quasi, you know, political issue, but the challenges are that we sit in the Bronx in a community, and though it's not a baseball operations challenge, and it's an organizational challenge, so the challenge is to make sure that we aren't an ivory tower, that we don't sit there as this, you know, Michael Kay once, when he first was talking about the stadium, I think he wanted to call it, you know, a monolith, but he had instead, it was mausoleum. So in the broadcast, he said, and here we are in the mausoleum in the Bronx. And I got on the phone with Jason Zillow, like, the challenge is organizationally making sure that we are a part of the community. That's the challenge. And sometimes we succeed and sometimes we fail. And so, what's part two?
Part two was the rewards.
Oh, the rewards.
Being in the Bronx.
The rewards are actually being in the Bronx. The rewards are that it's an historic neighborhood in New York. It's very New York. So you, when you come up to the Bronx, you would not think that you're in, you know, for example, my beloved San Francisco. You will know that you are in New York. There are New Yorkers around you, genuine New Yorkers. You know, it's a little bit like a foreign species, but, you know, you see them everywhere. It's not like, I mean, I was walking here in Midtown, and I was one of those people that was from another city, you know, in another state. So I was one of those people working in Manhattan from another place. And there are a lot of us, you know, come from someplace else. So that's the beauty of the Bronx, and the good thing is the Bronx hasn't changed, and the bad thing is the Bronx hasn't changed. So I think what was contemplated and contemplated by the Bronx was that the stadium would change life in the Bronx. And I think what it's mainly done is the folks across from us just have noise pollution when we have like a band on the top. That's so I think those are, you know, pluses and minuses, but I think they're actually a little bit of both, unfortunately.
Okay. And finally, I don't know how many people know this, but you were an actor on the stage through college. How are actors like ballplayers like actors, and how are the relationships similar or different with their fan bases?
I think they're very much the same. So both entertainers. So they're both entertainers. They're both in an industry where you suffer tremendous blows to your ego. So on a daily basis, you know, the players go out there, and when we're on the road, I hear the most horrific things yelled at them. I mean, just horrible things. And so you have to have a fairly strong sense of self and a very strong, you know, ego. You have to be comfortable in your own skin, and you have to focus on what you're doing. So both are entertainers. Both are, high, you know, when you succeed, it's tremendous. When you fail, it's miserable. So I think that is absolutely the way they're very similar. And in a lot of ways, I used to think of, so the clubhouse is like a dressing room. And for me, there should be a period of time, no offense to the media, but there should be a period of time when, you know, you want to prepare for the role that you're going to play as a ball player. And so there should be, I think, more of an opportunity for players to just kind of prepare. And the relationship with the fan base, well, you know, when you're in a very public profession, there are people that love you, there are people that hate you. I think the difference with ball players is that there are more people that hate you, not because of who you are, but because you're wearing the wrong uniform. And I think that's more difficult, you know, than with actors. With actors, they just don't like your performance. You know, it doesn't matter if you show up in a Yankee jacket or a Mets jacket. So, but I think that's a, you know, it's a really interesting, I'm gonna tell the players about that.
Okay. All right, we have some questions here from the audience, and this is for both of us.
Okay.
What do you see are still the biggest barriers to entry and advancement for women in your respective industries? For the media, I think the biggest barrier right now is that our industries are shrinking at a time when we're trying to convince people of color and gender and choice, if you speak to the gay community, minority communities of any sort, to please believe us when we are talking diversity. And yet, especially the print media and of late the electronic media, we're shrinking. So it's a mixed message, and it's one we're trying to wrap our arms around. When I go to colleges, I implore the youngsters who are on the verge of graduation, please believe us. The written word, the spoken messages are always going to be needed, but it's going to be up to them to find the delivery methods. It might not be newspapers that you hold in your hand. They're going to have to figure it out. There's always going to be a need to get that message out to the public. So, and diversity is so, so important. So for women and people of color, I implore them to never, ever stop fighting and pushing against the barriers, whether the barriers are limited jobs or leftover prejudices. Just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. It can be done. You can break through.
I am a very big fan of the media. And the print media and the written word. So I hope that members of the media will, you know, keep on fighting the good fight and keep on printing things that need to be read. I think I may have addressed it before. I think probably the greatest barrier is opportunity and recognizing opportunity and clubs recognizing I think you refer to it as old prejudices, you know, sloughing aside the old prejudice about that still exists about women in business, and just recognizing that, you know, the mind is well, actually, I think men and women think differently, but I think that, and that goes into bringing different points of view into a front office, but you have to slough off old prejudices about a woman in business. So I think it's opportunity, and I think it's clubs recognizing that there should be more women and more people of color in front offices.
Jean, this is for you. What was the most difficult contract you ever worked on?
Probably Irabu's contract. The things leading up to Irabu's contract. So a contract, they're sort of all the same. They all have the same, even the guaranteed provisions. They all have the same clauses in them. We did actually have a client, Katz Maeda, who was a minor league Japanese player, and his thing was different hair colors. Mm-hmm. I like to remember it this way. It may not be true, but since that contract probably is long lost, who's going to prove me wrong? But I believe that, in my memory, George actually agreed to have a colored hair clause in the contract because he thought that would. He was convinced that he was a minor league player, and we convinced him that this was Maeda's thing and that would, you know, attract more fans. So that was probably the most challenging was Irabu. Was there a second part? I keep forgetting the second
that was,
part.
But there is a second question. Oh. Which of all the Yankee teams is your favorite?
I get the current one. You happen to. You can't say.
Are you about to plead the fifth?
Pleading the fifth. It's a constitutional violation. I've been fortunate. I worked with great teams, great players over the years, and I've enjoyed working with all of them. We really have an extraordinary group of men who wear the uniform, and every team has in each year. You know, I feel like a kid, you know, this is my favorite year. And then the next year comes, no, this is my favorite year. So anyway, that's my roundabout answer to that question.
Well, here's another tough one. Will the Red Sox and the Yankees ever make a trade with each other again?
So I like to think, that if we ever did, it would have a similar outcome. But I don't think that there's sort of, baseball is riddled with unwritten rules, you know, so I think there's an unwritten rule that you never really trade with somebody in your own division, particularly if they are two words, one beginning with an R and the other beginning with an S. So I don't think that's something that we would probably do, but who knows? You know, anything's possible.
Suppose they offered you a pitcher who also hits home runs, and all you had to do is give up some money for a Broadway show.
That sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, I think I'd make that. Okay,
sounds familiar.
This one's for me. This has a little personal touch to it. I'm from Bristol, PA. That's where I raised my son. It's signed Mark Kantner. I think I see him in the audience. Okay. I want to know who were your mentors at the Courier-Times. I worked at the Bucks County Courier-Times, my first paper. Carl Laveau, John Sweeney, Kathy Canavan. Mark, you're probably the only one in the room who know those people, but it was my... So did I. Okay. I was in Bristol, sir.
When were you there?
I lived in Bristol from 90 to 2007.
Wow, it's a long time.
Yes, sir. My parents are buried there, Mark. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, my heart's still there. I'm a Bucks County girl, and I thank you. Thank you so much. That's the last question, and it's such a privilege sitting here with Jean. I love every moment I spend with her at Yankee Stadium. I grew up in Yankee Stadium as a writer. And I thank you all for coming out and joining us today.